The reading's taken from Mark chapter 10, starting to read at verse 35, and that can be found on page 1015 of the Church Bibles. That's Mark chapter 10, starting at verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside, begging. When he heard that it was Jesus, the son of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road.
Anna, thank you very much. Please hold that passage open and turn back, in fact, to verse 45. That's the main one we're going to look at this evening. Speaking of Jesus, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Well, I want to let you know as we start that tonight's sermon is directed at six people. I've got their names here in front of me, and looking around I can see that most of them are here, so that's a good start. Let me tell you how I came across them. I was working here in the office one day, and I came downstairs expecting to find one of our Bible study groups serving. If you're a regular here at St. Helens, you'll know that about 100 people on a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, 100, 200, something like that, come to study the Bible here midweek. And one Bible study group of 7 or 8 people come to act as dinner ladies or gentlemen for the evening for them. They serve the food, they do the washing up, that kind of thing. As I say, there's about 7 or 8 in each group on average, and they're normally here working away, beavering away, as I head home from the office. On that particular evening, there were only 2 people there. I wonder if you're beginning to think if you're one of the 6. There were only 2 there. So I asked them where the rest of the group was. I wondered if maybe they'd been stuck at work, there was a family emergency, sick in bed or something. Sometimes these things happen, and you just can't be here. It turned out that one of them was at a party. One of them was hosting a party. One of them was at the cinema. One of them was writing an essay, and the other one hadn't bothered to return the email. Well, those 6 are the target audience this evening. You 6, and anyone else that has ever done that, or anyone that is ever tempted to serve themselves when they could be serving Jesus. That's the question this evening, then. Who do you serve? Whose interests govern your decisions? When you're deciding what you're going to do with your time, which hobbies you're going to pursue, which areas of church life you're going to be involved in, what you're going to do after work when your name's on a rota, what is your core value? Who do you serve, yourself or Jesus? I want to say right at the start, the aim is not to make us feel guilty this evening. That's the easiest thing in the world to do. And guilt tends to work for a short time. It produces an increase of activity, but it doesn't change hearts and lives. And so we're not about guilt this evening. Our aim is that we'll get such a clear picture of Jesus, the servant king, that as we look at him, we will begin to serve in the right way and for the right reason. So that's our first point this evening, the right reason to serve. You can see there's an outline on the back of the new sheet that you were given as you came in. The right reason to serve, first of all, it's this: serve because Jesus serves. It's important we get the motivation straight if we're going to serve at all. Let's read from verse 42 in our passage once again. Jesus called them together and said to them, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them," literally tyrannize them, "and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all." Then our verse 4. "Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve." I wonder if you've noticed the rule in life, that the more important we are, the more people run around after us and the better we get treated by them. When you started at the firm, you're often at the bottom of the ladder and no one knows your name. When you've been there a while, even the security guard knows who you are. And you get let in even when you haven't got your security pass. Soon someone else is making your coffee and doing your photocopying, and so you progress. And the more important we get, the more people run around after us. And that, it seems, is how our world views greatness, isn't it? Not serving, but being served by others. The politicians of Jesus' day were like that. They were described famously as blood-sucking flies gorging themselves on wounded men. They lorded it over people. They wanted greatness. Let me ask you how you view greatness in the world. Do you think of cracking the whip over people? Maybe you think of achievement or of reputation or of status of one kind or another. Let me ask again how you view greatness in the church. Maybe you think of some title, be it senior Bible study leader or archbishop. Maybe you think of preaching to crowds of thousands. Maybe you think of producing perfect babies for the Sunday school and having the perfect family life. Maybe you think of working for the church full time. Well, not so with you, says Jesus. Not so with you. You are to be servants, a slave to all. Why? Verse 45. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life for others." Followers of Jesus are to view themselves as servants, then slaves to the people around them. Why? Because even Jesus lived like that. And when you look at the life of Jesus, you see a life of perfect service. You know, on no occasion in his life did he put his own interests before the interests of those around him. He never manipulated people to get his own way when there was a decision to be made or a plan to be cast. He never finished off the chocolate so no one else was looking. He never feigned illness or tears to get a little bit more attention from the people around him. He was the perfect servant. Glimpses of such humility are remarkable in any man or woman, but it's even more staggering when we consider who Jesus was. You see the title he gives himself there in the verse, the Son of Man. It's his favourite name for himself, actually. I think it comes up about 82 occasions, I think, in the four Gospels. And as I say, it's what he calls himself more than anything else. And you may know it's a technical title that comes from the Old Testament, from Daniel chapter 7. I've got it on the sheet there, page 892, if you want to turn to it. Don't bother if you don't. I'll read to you verses 13 and 14. "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days," that's God, "and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion was an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom, one that will never be destroyed." Just pause on the words with me for a moment. The Son of Man, you'll notice, has free access to God's presence. The Son of Man has the highest authority in the universe. The Son of Man is worshipped by people from every country and every language all over the world. The Son of Man has a kingdom that is timeless. You get the sense that the writer is almost tripping over his own feet, don't you? You can't find the words with sufficient majesty to express the greatness of this Son of Man. Kingdoms may come and empires will go, but this Son of Man will endure forever. He is nothing less than God. Just within Mark's Gospel, Jesus says that the Son of Man has God's authority on earth to forgive people for their rebellion against God. That this Son of Man would rise from the dead, that he would sit at the right hand of God in heaven, and that he would come again in his Father's glory on clouds to judge the world. That is what the Son of Man is like. He has all the authority of God. And yet, as we prayed earlier, he didn't consider equality with God something to be grasped, something to be utilized for his own advantage. But he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a slave, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. And so, Christian, the logic goes, you serve because even Jesus serves. If even Jesus serves, then a follower of his should serve as well. That's what a Christian is, isn't it? A follower of Jesus. So can you see how odd it would be if someone claimed to follow Jesus, but were nothing like him? If rather than serving other people, we expected the world to revolve around us and our plans and ambitions, it would show we think we're better than Jesus. It's great in theory, isn't it? But I've got to tell you, when it comes to putting this verse into practice, it still perplexes me. I think I must have come across it dozens of times over the years, and I've taught on it more than once. But still, I don't serve for the right reasons. Let me tell you what I mean. Maybe you can relate to this. Even when I find myself doing the right thing in the Christian life, very often it's for the wrong reason. So I serve, but in part at least, that's because it makes me feel better about myself. I don't know why that is. It's rarely a conscious decision, but I do enjoy the knowledge that I'm serving, as though it makes me a better person. Again, I serve, or in part at least, that's because I want the other people around me to think of me as being a servant-hearted kind of guy. I want them to have a higher opinion of me. Shameful even to mention it, isn't it? Serving for the wrong reasons. Can you see how wrong that is? I'm not serving because Jesus serves. I'm just like the disciples in the passage. I want to be great. I want to be seen to be great by others. Even my service of others is just a veil for serving myself in those cases. And that is not a Christian attitude. It is not serving for the right reason. So let's be clear about this then before we move on. And why not let's ask each other how we're doing on this motivation for Christian living in the weeks and months to come. The right reason to serve is our first point. And it is because Jesus serves, not for us our own benefit. If even the Son of Man is a slave, why wouldn't you be? First point then, serve because Jesus serves. Second, serve in the way that Jesus serves. I think there's a general feeling here at St. Helens that planting this church in West London has been good for us in this whole area of service. We've said before that the people that left, the 100 or so that left, were filling 80% of the rotas that we had going here at church. And their places have been filled by others very quickly. Indeed, many of us have signed up to do all manner of things that we'd never have dreamt of doing before they left. And that's got to be good for us. And the week of talks year by year produces a similar effect, doesn't it? Loads more people serving than would do on a week by week basis. And I've no doubt that there are many people at St. Helens here who are already at their limit in serving Jesus. And in some cases, some are doing too much. So this isn't just a beat up. But still we need to feel the challenge of Jesus' words. Because there is much more to serving other people than to volunteering for something on one evening of the year. Or for putting our name down on a rota. Service in the Bible is much more an attitude of the heart than it is a name on a rota. And so over the last few months I've read through Mark's Gospel a couple of times and thought about Jesus' attitude to the world around him. You may know that in chapter 1 verse 40... Jesus comes across a leper. A man with leprosy comes to Jesus and begs him on his knees and says, "If you are willing, Jesus, you can make me clean." And Mark writes, filled with compassion, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he says, "be clean." And what I want us to see is that at the sight of physical suffering like that, Jesus was filled with compassion. In the context of Mark's gospel, the main reason that the account is there is to show us the authority of Jesus over disease, even incurable diseases like leprosy. It shows us that he's God. But you'll see that Jesus wasn't showing his authority in some cold and mechanical way that was divorced from the person sitting in front of him. It says he had compassion on him. And it means he had compassion on him. He saw physical need, and he responded as he was able. Now, you'll have to tell me if you think I'm making too much of this, but I take it that it means if I'm to serve like Jesus, then as I see physical suffering around me, I too will be filled with compassion and respond as I am able. Obviously, I won't be able to heal people. I won't be able to feed 5,000 with a packed lunch. I won't be able to raise the dead in the way that Jesus did. But I will have compassion. I won't be able to do everything, but I may be able to do something. Doesn't mean, again, I'll give money to every beggar that I see, but I certainly won't walk past them as though they're less than human or have less of a right to life than I do. I will have compassion as I see physical need. And I'll also have compassion at the sight of spiritual need around me. Flip back a couple of pages to chapter 6, verse 34 for this one, please. Jesus sees a large crowd gathering around him. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, the verse reads, he had compassion on them. You'll notice, not because they were hungry or sick, but because they were like sheep without a shepherd, spiritually lost. And so he began to teach them many things. All the way through Mark's gospel, Jesus' big priority, way above the physical need around him, was to teach people. The people didn't know God. They didn't understand him. And so Jesus was filled with compassion towards them and responded as he was able. Again, it's obvious, isn't it? I can't meet our world's spiritual need. Only Jesus can do that. But I will be filled with compassion by it. I won't ignore it. I won't live as though the truths that the Bible teaches about heaven and hell aren't true or aren't something that need to occupy me. You'll see, I'm not saying that we can do the things that Jesus did. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that he was compassionate and servant-hearted towards those around him in need, be it physical or spiritual. And so if we're to be servant-hearted like Jesus, then we should have the same attitude, even when it's not convenient. This is amazing. There's this great little incident in chapter 7, verse 24, over the page if you would. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and didn't want anyone to know it. Yet he couldn't keep his presence a secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. You see, Jesus withdrawing from the crowds, hiding himself in the house. He doesn't want anyone to know where he is. Sure enough, though, the crowds find out and the woman comes to the house. How would you react if Jesus was a pop star? My guess is at that point he would swear at the cameraman, he'd complain about invasion of privacy and drive off in a fast car. But he's not like that, is he? He stops and he talks to the woman. It couldn't have been less convenient. It's some of Jesus' only recorded time off in Mark's gospel, but still he helped her. Do you see how his was a life of service? He almost couldn't help himself. Service wasn't something that was grudging. It wasn't something to do when people were watching. It wasn't something to do when his name was on a rota. It was his life. And of course, it was his death. Back to Mark 10, please, if you're not there already. This is the ultimate expression, isn't it, of Jesus' commitment to other people. Verse 45 again, for the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus is so committed to people that he is even willing to die for them. And these aren't people who had endeared themselves to Jesus. They'd been with him for 3 years by this stage, and he'd been telling them day after day about how he'd have to die and rise again. And they, time and again, had failed to understand what he was on about. I think in his position, I'd have given up on them by now and gone to find a new batch of followers. Well, here's how Jesus serves people. When his disciples failed him, he didn't abandon them. He died for them. It is not a small thing that Jesus should die for us. Can you think of the pain that he went through, the mental agony of living with his impending death, the emotional agony of being deserted by friends, the physical agony of the flogging and the mocking and being beaten about the head with a stick before crucifixion? Above all, the spiritual agony of bearing the full weight of God's wrath against all the rebellion of every Christian in every age. On the cross, Jesus went through hell, literally and willingly, to ransom me, to free me from my slavery to sin, my rebellion against God. It is an amazing thing. Can you imagine being that committed to someone? Can you imagine being that committed to an enemy? Well, that is the example of service that Christians are told to follow. You are to be a slave, says Jesus, not just to your friends, but to all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. A slave, there's no honour in this job. There's no working hours directive. There's no bonus scheme. There's no room for negotiation. Jesus picks the word slave precisely because it refers to the lowest of the low, someone with no rights at all, someone who doesn't belong to themselves, someone who doesn't have any independence. A slave. And that is to be our aim. The Christian will not aspire to be the greatest of the great. They will aspire to be a slave, the lowest of the low. A slave to everyone, all of the time. It's not a requirement for an elite band of Christians or people on the loony fringe of things. It's not a requirement for those in full-time Christian work or those with a more conducive life situation. If you're a Christian, this is for you. People often say that being a Christian is about being like Jesus, don't they? And that's absolutely true. But it can sound quite glamorous, can't it? Being like Jesus, being like God. You could get used to that. What we're saying here is that being like Jesus is being a slave. Greatness is slave-likeness. I wonder if you'll make it your goal then this week in life to be a slave. This is authentic Christianity, actively aspiring to the lowest position to serve other people. And what makes the job description so striking is the context in which it comes. As we had read to us in verse 35, two of Jesus' closest followers, James and John, glance down to it, come to him and ask him to do them a favour. We want you to do for us whatever we ask. Jesus says, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they reply, "Let one of us sit at your right hand and the other at your left in glory." So James and John clearly see that Jesus is very important. They clearly see that he's on his way to glory. And basically, they want a piece of the action. They want to be great. They want everyone to know who they are. They want their reputation to precede them. But the sphere of their ambitions is interesting, isn't it? They don't want to be great in the world's eye, in the office. They want to be great in God's kingdom. It's quite easy to sacrifice greatness in the world's eye if it's replaced by greatness at church, isn't it? But it is a little sick that it doesn't mean giving up your desire for greatness, just shifting the sphere in which we want it. "But not so with you," says Jesus. "Be a slave to all." So here's the question. Is this the way we view ourselves this evening? If I'd ask you to describe yourself in a single word at the start of our time together this evening, how many of us would have gone for slave? Not many is my guess. When you think of the people sitting near you now, the people in the Bible study groups here at St. Helens, the people in your home church if you're not with us regularly, is it our constant question to ask, "What can I do to serve these people?" This may help you answer the question, what are your limits in service? What are our limits in serving Jesus? Do you know, statisticians would tell us that thousands of people will die for Jesus this week. somewhere around the world simply because of their trust in him. But I'm not going to ask if you'd be willing to die for Jesus, because it's unlikely we'll have to do that this week, praise God, in this country. The big decisions are sometimes the easiest ones to take, aren't they? But I do want us to ask ourselves, will we allow our independence to die for Jesus this week, forever? Might mean taking it on ourselves to organise a social for our Bible study group rather than leaving it to the leader. Might mean missing catching up with a friend to chat to someone who's at church for the first time. Might mean dropping a note to someone who's in trouble. Where do you draw your line in your service of other people? The point is that slaves don't draw lines. They don't have a choice. It's just not an option for them. That's why we've called this sermon No Limits, because slaves have no limits. So here's our question to talk about afterwards. What are our limits in serving Jesus? At what point do we flinch and say, I'm sorry, his demands are too high for me? In the area of time, what would it be? Would it be an evening or two a week to help with the youth work? Would that be too much? Would it be 8 days of annual leave in the summer to help with a camp? Would it be missing a birthday party or a night in to wait on tables with my group? No limits. With our money, it's true that we've got responsibilities, haven't we? And we need enough money to live on. But 2 Corinthians 12:15, let me read this to you. Paul says to the Corinthians, I will gladly spend for you everything I have. The apostle worked at night so he could preach by day. So once you've been fed and housed, what are your limits in what you'll give to Jesus financially? Would the cost of a holiday be too much for him? Would the cost of a car be too much for him? What are your limits? With our energy, it's true we need to look after ourselves, but Paul goes on in that verse, I'll gladly spend for you everything I have, and I will expend myself as well, gladly. No limits. So what are the non-negotiables in life? The things that we won't do without. It might be a sports team we're committed to. It might be a particular type of job. No limits. I wonder, would you leave your job if it were appropriate and move to an easier one? Not just to a different big firm, if that's you, with slightly easier hours. But would you downscale your profession for the sake of Jesus? It's a bit of a cliche, but would you be a road sweeper to serve Jesus if that is what were best? Would you do full-time Christian work to serve Jesus if that is what were best? Would you let your children's grades suffer for them to serve Jesus if that is what were best? What are your limits? Will we make it our goal to be a slave to all, no matter what the cost to ourselves? There are to be no limits. I wonder if I'm willing to be nothing for Jesus. See how the normal Christian life has the shape of death about it. It's about taking up my cross, constant self-sacrifice for the good of others. Slavery is a way of life, not a name on a rota. Now, we said before, some of us are at our absolute limit. I'm aware of that. We feel the pain of our slavery to others every day. We couldn't do any more for Jesus. Then be encouraged. Yours is authentic Christianity. We were sitting in Christianity Explored last term, and one of the course participants said, if Jesus really is God, you could never do too much for him, could you? This is extreme Christianity with no limits. It's not a lunatic fringe. It is authentic, orthodox Christianity. The disciples were responding in the wrong way to Jesus. They wanted to be great, and we're not to copy them. Jesus is the Son of Man. We don't make demands of him. Instead, we're to copy Bartimaeus in this story. Blind Bartimaeus ironically saw things perfectly. Do you see what he says to Jesus? It's there in verse 47. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus stopped and said, call him. So they called to the blind man, cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you. Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. And then it's the same question that Jesus asked the disciples. What do you want me to do for you? Jesus asked him. The blind man said, Rabbi, I want to see. Go, said Jesus. Your faith has healed you. Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. The right response to the Son of Man is to beg for mercy. Whoever we are, we need to do that again this evening. Some of us may never have done it before. We've spent life living for ourselves, striving for greatness. We need God's mercy. Why not ask him for it this evening? Why not fill in the box on the back of the sheet and come along to a Christianity Explored course here at St. Helens? They're designed for people thinking about their position before Jesus. Maybe some of us have sought Jesus' mercy in the past, but we've still been seeking greatness. Maybe in the world's eyes, maybe in the church's eyes, maybe in both. We need his mercy again. Not so with you, says Jesus. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all. Slaves of Jesus have no limits, for even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Let's pray together. Lord Jesus, suffering servant, heavenly King, Son of Man, we praise you for your example to us. We praise you that when you came to earth, you came not to be served, but to serve. We praise you that you are willing to die for us. And we confess that we do not have that same attitude. We pursue our own interests and goals and ambitions, and not those, and do not live a life of service to those around us. And we ask that you would forgive us. With Bartimaeus we say, Son of David, have mercy on us. And please, by your Spirit, so change our hearts that we live lives of service to one another this week. For your name's sake, we pray. Amen.